This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. I'm in LA to interview one of my favorite people on the left, one of the few people on the left who continues to be primarily interested in ending the American empire, something I care a lot about. This is my interview with Abby Martin. So Abby Martin's here. We are in LA in your neighborhood, Highland Park, and we have a couple things in common. One is that we're both from the Bay Area. You from sort of the greater Bay Area. I'm from Berkeley, the real deal.
Right.
The other thing we have in common is that we both hate American foreign policy consistently, relentlessly, always. The other thing we have in common is that, well, we were at one time socialists. You know, I no longer am. I think you still are. We'll talk about that later. But let's get into like why you're one of the very few lefties, I would say, who cares a lot about American foreign policy and war, you know, because don't you agree that it's a minority passion on the left? I mean, I know the sort of the very serious left Marxist types tend to be quite good on foreign policy, or at least anti-interventionists, but like so much of the liberal left just ignores it. Does that sound right?
Yeah,
to
I mean,
you?
That's where I can agree with people who are like libertarian anti-interventionist leaning, because we all kind of agree that we don't want U.S. imperialism. We don't want regime change wars, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that the definition of the left is wrong. I think that we're talking about the neoliberal, you know, bubble, the mm-hmm. consensus that kind of takes over American society. That's mostly corporatist. And a lot of these people are not leftist whatsoever. You know, mm-hmm. I think that we're just used to thinking that liberal equals left when really it's not, because we're brainwashed by the corporate media to just think of things in this bipartisan lens where mm-hmm. the Democrats are left and the Republicans are right. And right. really, I think we both know that that's not what leftist ideology is in mm-hmm. any sense of the word. And I think a lot of the actual anti-imperialist Marxists, socialists, communists that I know are extremely good on foreign policy.
Yes.
Because it just goes hand in hand with
all
their ideology.
In the United States, right? There's not a lot of you.
There's not that many.
Yeah. Right? I'm going to do something that I promised we wouldn't do right before we shot. I promised we wouldn't talk about Bernie Sanders, but actually this mm-hmm. is very relevant now, right? Because
sure.
we were just talking before we started rolling that Bernie in the last campaign basically didn't mention foreign policy at all, right?
Yeah.
He's just started to in this campaign. So, but wouldn't you consider him to be more than just a liberal? He's definitely close to socialism, isn't he?
Well, he calls himself a democratic socialist. Yeah. And I think there's a difference between a democratic socialist and an actual socialist. These terms have been kind of intermixed. And I think that what Bernie Sanders really is a social democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going back to what FDR was, which is just widespread social programs and not really the takeover of every industry, you know, the government seizure of these things. He is talking about nationalization of certain public utilities, which I find very important as well.
And minor league baseball. I find that very important too. He's big on that these days.
But no, I think it's kind of done a disservice to the fundamental understanding of what these terms and ideologies mean, because social democracy is not what democratic socialism is. And so the popularization of the DSA and the Bernie Sanders movement has made people think, oh, I'm a democratic socialist, when really, if you look at the terms and the breakdown of what that means, they they don't really apply. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I think that Bernie Sanders definitely is the most left president that we've had, maybe.
Candidate.
Yeah, candidate. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Hopeful thinking there. Hopeful, hopeful Freudian slip there.
Presidential candidate that we've seen in probably 100 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think he's a social democrat. And I used to be a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, which you mentioned. But isn't it remarkable that, I mean, I think a lot of socialists, real socialists, supported him enthusiastically in the last election and this one too. And yet they didn't seem to mind that he never mentioned foreign policy. I was frankly disgusted by that. I mean, the left used to, when I was growing up in the Bay Area in the 70s and 80s, you know, we talked constantly about Central America. Before that, it was Vietnam. I mean, I sort of grew up around anti-war people, and that was their primary kind of passion or motivation, actually, you know. And I just don't see that anymore, except for among a very few people like you, other people I've had on the show. But do you have an explanation for that? Or do you see the same thing that I see? Like a declining interest in foreign policy on the left?
I think in the neoliberal arenas, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I can't speak to how things were before I was on this earth, but I do think that neoliberalism has been such a corrupting force and has really toxified the narrative where people actually do think, and I think that we're among the most ideologized, I don't know what the word is, brainwashed, I guess is another term for it, peoples in the entire world, right? Where we actually think it's not just that our government is doing these things in our name. We actually believe that we are the best. Mm-hmm. We actually believe that we deserve to be taking over these countries, quote unquote, helping people, that we're the arbiter of human rights and democracy around the world. And so I think that people who call themselves liberals and think that they're left-leaning and believe in progressive social policies still will fall prey to these trappings of imperialism. Well, they'll say, we need to therefore help other progressive movements around the world. We need to therefore, you know, topple suppressive authoritarian regimes without understanding how detrimental and destructive that is and absurd of a notion that is.
Right. So, I was going to say, you said something like, we feel like we can do things like regime change and nation building and imperialism in other countries, but then you changed your terminology, and I agreed with the change, which is that we actually feel obligated, like it's our responsibility as the greatest, most powerful nation on earth, to help others, to make them live more like us, live more like Americans. This has been, I think, the discourse in American foreign policy since the beginning. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right? It's like, it's not just that we can do this, but that we should. In fact, you're a bad person for getting in the way of it or not doing it.
But would you say that neoliberalism has changed that dogma to make people think that it's more palatable to liberals and leftists, whereas during the 60s and 70s, before the Reagan era and before like the Clinton takeover? I mean, you tell me.
So we already have. So this is our first problem between you and me. You use the term neoliberalism. No, it's fine. But I want you to define it. If we define it, then we might agree. How do you define neoliberalism in this case?
I think the kind of this corporate takeover of democratic values and principles. So it's a really good question because it's been interpreted in so many different ways.
It's been used for so many things. Right.
I mean, I think that where would you say neoliberalism really started? In the Clinton era?
For me, neoliberalism only has meaning in its original usage, which was in Chile in the early 1970s, right? When the Friedman School, the Chicago economist, went down to Chile and helped Pinochet set up his economic system, which was forced privatization,
right?
You know, at the point of a gun, literally. So if that's, you know, that's not laissez-faire because the government was pushing these policies, but that made sense to me. That's when it was coined, I believe, was during that time. And so if it's in reference to sort of forcibly privatizing industries, but with the government essentially managing both the transition and ultimately parts of the industries themselves, that's when neoliberalism was used. And if you want to describe that kind of process as neoliberalism, I'm cool with it. It's just that it gets, not you, but other people have used it to describe everything from private prisons to like people's attitudes about shopping to, you know, I mean, everything.
I think it's what has become, I think it's what the outgrowth is of that kind of model that has been applied since. I mean, forced privatization of a lot of things. Of course, you could go back to the post I'm sorry, the Pinochet era, this is why we're seeing problems in Chile today, because that never was rectified, right? They never really overthrew the neoliberal model in that country, which is what they're dealing with right now. But I think the application of privatization is the problem here, where people don't point to capitalism and privatization as the culprit, though, because again, you go in terms of the brainwashing and conditioning and this kind of worshiping of capitalism, where capitalism just seems like it's now benign and also, you know, gay friendly, trans friendly, the kind of the pink washing of these things. So I guess it's not neoliberalism to a certain extent. It's just that while we have a system that's fully privatized, we also have been conditioned to think that it also provides avenue and spaces to marginalized identities and people who are oppressed. Mm-hmm. So I think that that has been a huge detriment to social consciousness and also just political consciousness in general. But I don't have an explanation why more liberals don't mm-hmm. care about foreign policy. Right. I just think that, again, like there is a really toxic syndrome of American exceptionalism mm-hmm. and it's a disease, and people actually are born with the idea that we are better
mm-hmm.
and that we should be doing these things, that we have a higher place in society, which is very, very sick.
I agree with everything you said about American exceptionalism, and I disagreed with everything you said about capitalism, pretty mm-hmm. much, which is fine. So here's what I want to do. I want to talk about our backgrounds, because mm-hmm. so I was born into a Trotskyist family, mm-hmm. okay, during the Vietnam War. My parents were anti-war activists. They were professional revolutionary socialists, meaning they industrialized. They took jobs in factories to organize the workers for the revolution. So like, I go deep with this stuff. And I was a socialist. I was a member of a DSA, and I was a Marxist until my 30s, starting in the Bay Area, the sort of hub of the American left, you know, and I changed. As far as I understand, because I talked to your brother about this, you guys didn't come from a political family. Is that right?
Right.
And so were they just basically apolitical?
No, I mean, they were just staunchly Democratic, I would say.
But not passionately. They weren't like marching in the streets or...
No.
Okay.
No, yeah.
So then I asked Robbie this, and he didn't really have... Your brother, and he didn't really have an answer for this, or maybe there is no answer. I said, because I assume there had to be somebody or some group or something that got to you guys, and you know, you were influenced by. Is this true? And was there someone or something that you saw or listened to that changed your mind from loving the Democrats to becoming much more radical?
I mean, I would say 9/11 was a big catalyzing moment for both of us. I think first of all, just kind of becoming shocked that there was something that why did this happen to us? You know, like, first of all, I was a senior in high school, so it was just transitioning over to a freshman in college, where you're finally like taking classes in sociology and philosophy and challenging all these preconceived notions about, going back to the Clinton doctrine, like immigration, the death penalty, things that were pretty mm-hmm. conservative for so-called, you know, liberal Democrats to believe in. And so I think that going back to 9/11, my brother was a huge factor in my awakening, because he was just much more online and into just alternative media in general. And so he just kept, you know, sending me crazy videos and different...
Oh, it's Robbie's fault. Yeah, yeah, I should have brought this really up with him. I didn't know this. Okay.
But I was also at the time dating this really, really kind of crazy conservative guy, and as a senior in high school.
No kidding.
Yeah, really horrible. And he actually joined the military after 9/11. It's kind of different than my current partner, who joined the military a month before 9/11 and was thrown into the Iraq war, became an invading soldier, and is now an anti-imperialist, whereas the person that I was dating in high school became a crazy right-wing psychopath, very violent, and basically just, quote, wanted to kill ragheads in the Middle East. So taking that and then learning... just awakening. I mean, reading Blowback from Chalmers Johnson, having a case study in Okinawa, for example. Mm-hmm. And I just said, hold on, if this is what's happening just in this small island of Japan because of the takeover of U.S. military bases, what else are the, you know, 900 military bases around the world? What kind of effect is that having environmentally, culturally, socially? How is this degrading the mm-hmm. planet and impacting everyone? And I think it just went from there. But I think the Iraq war was another stepping stone, because 9/11... It was very traumatizing. You know, we were heavily brainwashed into the post 9/11 world and accepting this kind of new era that we were in and succumbing all of our personal liberties to the government. And then I think when the Iraq war happened, it was so confusing to me. I was very anti-Bush. I was so confused why Nancy Pelosi was not pursuing Bush for war crimes, right? I was like, this guy's a torturer. He started a gulag in Guantanamo Bay. He's doing all this crazy
and
stuff.
And Nancy's one of the good guys.
She's been a gatekeeper my whole life.
Nancy Pelosi is so obviously a good person. How could she do this?
She's horrible. But then the media selling that war, that got me on my journey to where I am today. So I was so confused. I remember waking up right after the media just transitioned one day, uniformly transitioned over to propaganda about Saddam Hussein. And I just could not wrap my mind around it. And everyone around me just went along with it. I remember, you know, it's a very militarized society in San Diego, which is where I went to school. So five military bases surrounded by military bros who were cheering on the bombing of Baghdad. And I felt like I was going to vomit. And I just said, how is this happening? How are you guys okay with this? How is this forced compliance into just invading and occupying a country that had nothing to do with this event? And why did the media do this to us? Why is the media not acting as a watchdog like they're supposed to be? So that just, you know, long story short, that's how I became on this journey to media activism and media literacy.
Okay. Yeah. So I have just time and time again come across, or people have come into my world doing this, doing the podcast, doing Renegade University, who are of your generation, which I call the 9/11 generation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just one after the other, many of whom started out pro-war, many of whom went into the military, like Mike, your husband, right? Mm-hmm. You're married, yeah. And then changed their politics once they were in, right? So I'd say there's a huge chunk of the people who listen to this podcast fit that description. They're your age, mid-30s-ish. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so that's that generation. A lot of them sort of went libertarian Ron Paul. Some of them went lefty like you guys. But there's an anti-war sort of impulse in there that really was stoked after the Iraq war invasion. And I guess that's why they hang out with me, because I'm interested in foreign policy. But it seems like much of the left, as I said, just has been increasingly focused on domestic policy, in particular identity politics.
Right.
And identity politics, I'm curious. I don't think I've heard you talk about this. Do you have? You must have thoughts on identity politics. I can guess what they might be, but what do you think?
I mean, I think identity politics has been a huge factor in the Trump era, not only the backlash and kind of the reaction to Trump of honing in on identity, right? But I think Trump won on identity politics. He won on white identity politics. And I think that that's a huge factor. So we can't downplay that. But I do think that identity politics have been weaponized by the system to embolden themselves. Just going back to what I said about kind of capitalism and the elites who are controlling society, they've weaponized identity to essentially just secure their power for generations to come by saying, look, we've made progress. We are uplifting, you know, we have Pete Buttigieg, we have a gay guy in the right race. We have a bunch of women, people of color. Mm-hmm. And then of course, going back to, you know, you have at the gay pride parade, you have, you know, bank floats that are LGBTQ friendly. You have pink tanks and you know, Israel.
pink tanks.
Oh,
they have like, pink tanks
they
in
have
Israel?
Pink like drones, and I'm pretty sure that they maybe not tanks, but I know that they have like very like breast cancer awareness and all that shit. I know that that's not necessarily identity politics, but it's just like making it palatable to progressives that empire and imperialism are good things.
As long as you put the pink triangle on the Hellfire missile, you know, as it's taking out a wedding party, we're great, you know, and Pete will endorse it. But identity politics. Oh, Dow Chemical. Did you see this recently? The CEO of Dow Chemical is now a gay man, and so they were trumpeting this on Twitter.
There you go.
And then Lockheed Martin now is a woman CEO, right?
Yeah.
And
we have Gina Haspel in charge of the CIA.
That's right. Several women are in charge, I think, heads of the big defense contractor corporations, right? And they say, well, look, this makes us good. And I think you're right. I think a lot of liberals, and I'm not talking about leftists, I'm talking about liberals, Democratic Party stalwart types, do actually buy that, and they become comfortable with entities like Dow Chemical and Lockheed Martin, which in my parents' generation in the 60s and 70s, that was the devil.
Right.
Those corporations were the worst of the worst of the worst. And now they get a pass because they have groovy people at the head of them, I guess.
Shocking.
Right. So, I mean, on that, I think we probably do agree. There is sort of a co-optation going on, right? Using identity to, I think, I think we do agree on this, you know, to use identity to distract essentially mm-hmm. from what you and I would say is really going on, which is the killing of innocents or and the invasion of places we shouldn't be invading mm-hmm. and the disruption of places and ecosystems and people's lives and whole countries, you know. Liberals are cool because I think with that, because I think they're mostly interested in feelings, number one. I think they're also interested in looking good. I think they like nice accessories. I think they like to have gay friends and black friends, and I think they like to have furniture in their house, furniture in their ideology that is multicolored, and they want to show that off to the world. Look where I live, look who my friends are, and now we're cool. And it also takes a lot of work, doesn't it, to be up on foreign policy. It's like really hard to stay current on foreign policy, and sure. Americans are notoriously ignorant, lazy, and fairly stupid when it comes to anything outside their immediate world.
Yeah, and they don't extend their empathy beyond the borders of this country, which I find hilarious. I mean, they obsess and seem outraged about kids in cages at the border, but it's like they have no connection to why these kids are being caged, how immigration has been exacerbated by U.S. foreign policy, and also just the kids living under our bombs around the world. It's like, why do you care about these kids, but then just go a couple more hundred miles and you just don't give a shit.
It is amazing.
About these kids. I don't get it.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, they're very upset when Trump cages kids, but when Obama was caging kids, which
not
he
so
did,
much.
Whatever, because
so
the cages
much.
Were actually, as you know, I'm sure, were built originally by Obama. He was originally separating families.
He was a statesman, that. I mean, he sounded good and he looked good, yeah, right?
I'm glad you agree.
So he made people comfortable.
That's why you're here. See, we have a lot of agreement here. We'll get to the capitalism stuff later.
Well, let's get to it now.
No. No, I like you too much. I don't want to fight yet. All right. So there was no particular like person who influenced right. you or Robbie. There was no like political party, you know, like with my parents, mm-hmm. they used to go around the International Socialist League, used to go around and recruit all kinds of people. You know, this was a big
wow,
deal.
So you were actual red diaper baby.
Oh, I mean, totally. But wow. Trotskyist.
Yeah.
So this
yeah.
is important.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, let me tell you this. All right. We'll get into, okay, here we'll do this difference between us. There's two, we have two major differences. One is on capitalism and one is on what I'm about to talk about. So during the anti-Vietnam War movement, there was a very important split that is not often talked about, mm-hmm. which is, and I do not want to trumpet my parents because they were shitty parents, and I'm not even, and I don't even agree with their politics then, but in this, I do like what they did. Their wing of the anti-war movement, which was mostly Trotskyist influenced, refused to be sympathetic to the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese.
Right.
In other words, they did not take a side except right. against the war, against the right. United States. Simply anti-imperialist, not pro-communist or pro-socialist mm-hmm. or pro-Viet Cong. And that is where I am still to this day, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I know that you didn't necessarily take that path. I mean, you have been supportive of some of the regimes that have been victims, I would agree. Of
what do you mean by supportive?
Of what you would, well, you can tell me, but of regimes that have been, and I agree with you, have been attacked. You could even say victims of U.S. foreign policy, but that doesn't make me a proponent of those governments or those regimes that are under attack by mm-hmm. United States. So, I mean, you've talked about Venezuela, the mm-hmm. Venezuelan government, right? And have been generally, am I right, generally supportive of it?
Oh, yeah. So I definitely
generally
think
in solidarity.
That yeah, I thought you were talking about like the DPRK and
oh,
stuff
North
like
Korea?
That. Yeah, yeah. So no,
no,
that,
no I know you
I
haven't
would
gone
say
there.
That there's a distinction between, you know, supporting governments like the Cuban government and
Cuba
Venezuelan
and
government
Venezuela, right.
versus, you know, governments that you could, you know, like Stalin or whatever. And I think that that's okay. that's an inaccurate description of what people, you know, will call my partner's organization, the PSL, which is the Party for Socialism and Liberation. There's a lot of Trotskyist communities who say that they're a Stalinist organization just because they say we defend the sovereignty of Syria or we defend the sovereignty of these countries. It doesn't mean that they support the policies. They just try to explain, oh. you know, the context behind them without condemning them, offering some sort of third way, which is like, we condemn Maduro's authoritarianism, but also support the leftists in the country. It's just, to me, that's a little bit confusing because you're also aiding imperialist rhetoric and not providing, like, to me, it's like when there's a country in the crosshairs of U.S. empire about mm-hmm. to be overthrown, like the mm-hmm. height of the coup in Venezuela, mm-hmm. I didn't feel the need to go out there and say all of the things about Venezuela that I thought Maduro could do better, or he did this wrong and he should have done the oil for this and whatever. There's people being in prison that are protesting. I just felt like we all need to kind of unify as leftists because we're such a small minority. There's such an overwhelming amount of propaganda to debunk the propaganda. Mm-hmm. And it's not really our responsibility to provide this kind of third way, very, very difficult to interpret position, which I think where the Trotskyists fall in line with, which is a little bit, I don't think, very useful at times like these.
Hmm. So, okay, I'm not exactly sure. So rhetorically, discursively, like what would be the difference between like that left, that old left position I've been talking about, that Trotskyist, anti-Stalinist position that is simply anti-imperialist in these cases, and your position?
Well, I guess I thought that you were talking about people like in terms of Venezuela. I remember when the coup was happening, there was a lot of people who called themselves socialists, and they would say, you know, they'd line out, they'd basically list serve all of the shit that Maduro's an authoritarian on, all of the things that are wrong with Venezuelan society. And then at the end, they'd say, but we support the people's movement there to rise up against this dictator. And I just don't think that that language is helpful. And it's also wrong, frankly. I don't think Maduro's a dictator either. Hmm. So I think that that's where we differ, where they're kind of aiding the rhetoric of the empire and helping the propaganda. But then they also kind of take this third position where it's like, but we should support the people, when the people clearly have voted for Maduro and it was a fair and free election. So that's what I'm saying, is that I don't understand the position because it's kind of unclear.
Hmm. Okay. You know more about Venezuela than I do. I'm not an expert on it, so I'm not going to go. I can't go too far on this. But, you know, people that I generally respect, you know, who have told me that, and I've done some research on this. I mean, there have been infringements clearly on free speech there, right? There has been punishment of political dissidents. As in almost every country, by the way. So I don't think it's an especially evil regime. I just don't ever support any government, regardless.
Well, I think that you have to look at the context of places like Cuba and like Venezuela, who have been under attack from the U.S. empire, right? Mm-hmm. Under attack from global capitalism since they have tried to install revolutions, right?
I agree.
And so you can look at Cuba almost out of necessity becoming a communist, quote unquote, dictatorship, because they had to expel the capitalist forces from the country. Venezuela has actually never done that. That is why they're having so many problems today. You can argue the merits of that or not, but when the Soviet Union existed, they were providing kind of an alternative source for Cuba to have a sustained economic bloc. Whereas now the Soviet Union, of course, does not exist. And so Venezuela not purging, they had no option but to participate in the global market.
Okay.
You can look out of, yeah, I mean, of course, you can argue the merits of Cuba not having, you know, allowing other political parties and ideologies and voting out the communists. But for their own survival, I understand why they did what they did. Hmm. For Venezuela's own survival, I understand them shutting down particular TV stations that were using the democratic process as a subversion tool to oust Maduro. A lot of these entities there are working with outside forces to try to, again, subvert the Bolivarian Revolution. So a lot of the actions that the Venezuelan government has taken has been out of self-preservation. And in fact, a lot of people have argued they haven't gone far enough to expel these forces. Like the fact that Juan Guaido, who was the coup puppet, incubated by, you know, under the tutelage of the IMF master here in DC, he was just gallivanting around the world. He seized all of this gold. I mean, Trump is paying Guaido and his puppet regime like $20 million out of USAID money. And this guy is just being able to run some kind of counter government. He should be arrested. this guy should be arrested. I mean, who is this person? So the fact that he hasn't, I think, speaks volumes to how overblown this notion of, you know, the fact that Venezuela cracks down on dissidents and stuff. I was there in the height of the violence in 2017 when all the news was reporting uniformly that Maduro's authoritarian forces were going down and just wantonly killing protesters. There were some headlines that were just like 300 dead by Maduro's forces. I went through death records. I saw all of the deaths, not all of them, I'm sorry, more than half of the deaths caused in the height of these protests was by the opposition protesters themselves. Mm-hmm. Flaming street barricades, actual just direct assassinations. Some of them were just people who got executed, electrocuted, looting, and they were included in these death tolls. And I was myself part of these protests. I saw what these opposition kind of hordes and mobs do firsthand. So anyway, my point is that I think when you break these things down, it's actually quite overblown, quite exaggerated. And that's just the way it is.
Okay. So my favorite all-time anti-war slogan, which I think originated in the Vietnam War era, is "out now." Two words. Mm-hmm. That's it. I love that. That sums up my foreign policy position on the United States. Just get out of everywhere.
Right.
And I guess I don't see why that's not sufficient.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people have argued with me, and I'm curious to hear what you say. It's like, if the U.S. isn't there, someone else would be, right? And if the U.S. isn't the empire, then who else would be? Right. And who else would take the place of the U.S.? I don't subscribe to that, though, because it's like, that doesn't make sense to me.
No. But again, I'm challenging you. Like, why isn't Out Now enough for you? It's not enough. Or is it?
Well, Out Now is not enough because people need to understand how we got here. So just having a simple slogan, yeah, it sounds great, but people don't understand. You know, they don't understand why these countries can be sovereign and sustain themselves without U.S., you know, stabilizing them. And I think you have to unmask and unpeel this really, really heavy propaganda and have people understand. Let's take us up to speed, like with Iran, for example. Let's look at the last 70 years of how we got here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Back to Venezuela, and then we'll finish this because I don't want to belabor this. But I think you said that because the opposition in Venezuela was in league with the CIA and other opponents, external opponents of the government there, which they were, I agree, that is reason to shut down their speech rights.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I said particular instances that will be levied by organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. When you actually look at the sourcing of these reports that merit your argument, right, which are underlying your premise, which is that Venezuela cracks down on free rights or free expression of the opposition, they actually do not. And when you look at these instances case by case, there's really interesting explanations of things that have happened. Like, for example, certain media organizations that have shut down because they were calling for the overthrow of Hugo Chavez. They were actually participants in the coup.
I know, but excuse me, but you and socialists have been calling for the overthrow of this government for more than a century, right? And then your rights, speech rights, have been abridged and infringed upon, and people have been thrown in jail and deported because of speaking that very language here. Right. And that's,
I'm not talking, I believe in democratic, I believe in democracy. Okay. I would like a democracy. I'm not talking about like the violent overthrow.
Sure. But you do know there's been a radical left.
I don't speak for those people though.
Yeah.
I don't represent those people.
But I know, but their rights, that was the justification, the premise for putting them in jail for their speech, was that they were advocating, this is not news, right? The overthrow of this government, right?
Okay.
Well, I mean, so it seems like that would be that's the argument that you're making against the opposition in Venezuela.
I think that's a false binary when you're looking at the world, and you could say the same thing like, oh, socialist governments they had their own imperialism, right? And the Soviet Union was trying to take over the world and this stuff. And you look at, let's look at the U.S. forces and U.S. empire compared to, and I don't want to get mired down in this because I'm not like a staunch communist or Marxist. I just am interested in Marxism because I think that capitalism we can do better. So I don't really want to get mired down in this too much, but I do think that what the Soviet Union was doing largely was trying to install like a global revolution of leftist movements, and they were not aiding reactionary Nazi right-wing movements like the US was doing to destroy and destabilize countries. It was quite the opposite, where they were trying to aid revolutionary forces. They weren't necessarily doing, the U.S. did pretty nefarious things.
Indeed.
Death squads, horrific genocides that took place. And I'm not going to argue, you know, the Stalin era versus what I'm talking about. I'm just saying that it's a different kind of thing. I guess I'm not really sure where you're going with that.
Okay. Let's switch topics slightly. This is actually a segue. So you actually have been accused, and I have been accused, of working for a foreign government.
Have you been accused of?
Hold on. You'll know where I'm going in a second. Of subverting our democracy.
Okay.
Recently. Because you and I have both been accused of working for Vladimir Putin.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Because if you call into question Hillary Clinton, or you say that Trump might have said something that was useful, that was slightly anti-imperialist, or, you know, the vaguest positive thing about Trump at all, you clearly are on the payroll of Russia and seeking to subvert democracy. Mm-hmm. Right?
Talking about
Russiagate.
Of course.
And you and I completely agree on Russiagate. I think it's an absolute hysteria. I think it was... Actually, let me hear what you... give it your quick analysis of Russiagate. Like, what was it... what's it really about?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's clearly bullshit and hysteria.
Yeah, I mean, back in 2015, really going on? When I was at RT, I think when the Crimea incursion happened, I think that that was the beginning stages of how I was understanding that they were going to try to use Russia to basically as our next enemy, our next so-called enemy, and to use it as this fear-mongering tool to ramp up military spending. We were honing in on the Sochi Olympics and demonizing Putin as the worst person in the world. And the Crimea thing was just another addition to that. But I think that once Trump's election took off, we were already seeing the beginning stages of Russiagate take place before he even won the election, where they were saying that he was Putin's chosen candidate, and just kind of everything around him was Putin propaganda. What RT was doing was aiding and abetting him. If you talked simply about Hillary Clinton's war crimes, like you just said, I mean, look at the DNI report. This was the long-awaited Director of National Intelligence, alongside 16 intelligence agencies, conclusive report on how Russia so-called interfered with the U.S. election, right? And a lot of people don't understand that they when they hear Russiagate, if you're not really well versed in this, they actually think Russia hacked, you know, actually in part, like literally hacked our election and made Trump win. And when you look at the actual evidence, it is so flimsy of what is hinging on the Russiagate hysteria. Yeah. It is actually a few Facebook ads, things that are so minuscule that could not have possibly swayed anything. But it was just so blown up and exaggerated. And when you look at the DNI report, I was so alarmed to find my name, my show, in the DNI report talking about how Breaking the Set, which actually ended 2 years prior to the election, that actually had a direct role in electing Donald Trump, because I was a foreign agent who was fomenting radical discontent about this country, which really goes to the core of why RT was such a threat. I don't know if you could still call it the same threat. It was a huge threat to the oligarchy, to the apparatus of corporate media, because it provided the space of what corporate media was not providing. Talking about libertarianism, talking about communism, giving people space that are not given space or platformed on corporate media or establishment media, and also just highlighting movements like Occupy Wall Street, right? Highlighting people like Jill Stein. That was the greatest crime they could have ever committed. So it wasn't, I mean, you'll never see anything of me praising Russia or praising Putin or anything like that. It was just simply talking about the reality of US empire, the reality of our foreign policy, and giving space and platforming third party candidates and social movements. And that was actually laid out quite explicitly in this report. They actually said covering fracking, things like this, that was fomenting radical discontent, which aided and abetted the election of Donald Trump.
For people who have not read the, was it Director of National Intelligence report on all this, which Abby's referring to, please read it. It's a comic book. It's one of the most absurd political documents I've ever seen produced by a nation state, frankly.
Yeah, it's
it is
shocking.
Absolutely silly. Antiwar.com is listed, and I've worked very closely with them. I have been on RT, not on your show, but several times, or was on RT several times. And so I was implicated, and I've been called by fairly important people, like a Russian stooge, you know, even me. But so for those
just who... Just for simply appearing on RT.
Oh, exactly. Wow. I was on, of course, to criticize American foreign policy a couple times, and you know, and I didn't like being on Putin's channel, but I still did it because it was the only, as you said, it was the only place where you had serious anti-imperialist voices, both left-wing and libertarian, and consistently for years, right? And so a lot of us went on that show or those shows on RT, and it was because it was the only place we could go. Oh, so for the very few people listening who don't know, you had a show, you were an anchor of a show on RT for several years. And can you, first of all, I don't know the story of the origin story of that. How did you get that gig? How did you get that
show? Actually, going back to Occupy Wall Street, after becoming a media activist and a running my own media site, which was Media Roots, and I still host a podcast on there and aggregate news on there. But I started it out of the Iraq War, you know, era, where I said, okay, it doesn't matter what your issue is, if it's war, if it's human rights, if it's just food or water, if you're not creating your own media and using media as a resource to get this information out there, it doesn't matter. You could be just yelling on the street with a cardboard sign and no one's going to fucking listen. So I started Media Roots, and I moved back to Oakland And I was working with Project Censored, which is the largest research organization in the country. They publish an annual
organization.
Book.
I love that.
Publish an annual book of the top 25 censored stories every year. Very incredible tool.
Awesome.
And research body. And love just became them. Self-taught at Berkeley Community Media and how to edit and how to film and how to do all these things. And so Occupy Wall Street kind of erupted in my backyard. Essentially a police state takeover to a very peaceful encampment of a couple hundred people, and there was just helicopters in the sky, lines of militarized police.
You're talking about in Oakland.
Yeah, in Oakland.
Which was the most violent sight of Occupy.
It was
right?
shocking. I was standing right next to Scott Olson when he got hit with the tear gas canister and is now partially brain damaged at point blank range. It was absolutely horrifying what they did. The wanton arrests, the mass arrests, and just the violent violence that was being perpetrated against them, raiding the camps and just all of this stuff. But what was so interesting, back to your point about like neoliberalism, there was a bent of Occupy that did not want to point to Obama, right? Who appointed all these Wall Street bankers in his cabinet. This was, you know, Occupy Wall Street happens a couple years after Obama gets elected. The Obama headquarters is right near Frank Ogawa Plaza downtown. And I was like, let's go occupy Obama's headquarters. And
there was just no
connection. It was just so bizarre. It's like, how do you not connect Wall Street to this administration?
Goldman Sachs is all over his administration.
Citigroup.
And neocons too.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it was stunning. And I think Obama really rebranded the empire in that way where people just said, well, we have a black president. And so we're, you know, this is progress. But so I was there reporting RT, this Russian channel that I didn't know what the hell it was the only news station that was taking Occupy Wall Street seriously.
Right.
And so I kind of became the de facto liaison for RT in DC, documenting what was going on. And I think they just saw a couple pieces of my previous work. I was doing like a proto Breaking the Set show on a network called Your Network, where I was talking about net neutrality and Obama's cabinet, how shady they were. And so they saw that work and juxtaposed with my Occupy Wall Street coverage, and they offered me the position. And I, of course, you can't not take that. Even though I had no professional experience in media, I was all self-taught. And so I anchored for a couple months and then just got the show.
How long were you the anchor on that show?
3 months. Oh, I'm sorry. No. The show for 2.5 years.
Yeah, 2.5 years. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And am I right? Primarily, you were into that show was primarily interested in foreign policy. Not exclusively, but primarily.
Yes,
right.
Primarily, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then you had a very famous break with RT. Can you, I know you've told this story before, but can you tell
it
again?
No, that's fine. And I think it goes back to the neoconservatives and the attacks on RT, how RT was kind of the pariah in Washington, D.C. Anyone who's lived in Washington, D.C. understands it's a fucking hellscape and horrible. And, you know, you're either part of the security surveillance system, defense contractor, corporate media, or just the political establishment. You're a horrible person, right? 90% of the people living there.
I'm not going to argue too strenuously against that. Yeah. Sorry, D.C. residents, but yeah, some of you are okay.
If you're there, you're probably doing something nefarious. Yeah. I was the pariah for 2.5 years. You know, you just kind of have a small circle. Long story short is when the Crimea incursion happened, I actually fell prey to a lot of the influx of propaganda that was coming on, where I actually thought that Russia was going to violently invade Ukraine. Because I was seeing, you know, these images of just military personnel and troops lining the border, and I didn't understand the complexity of the situation. I do not regret anything that happened. I still don't believe, I don't believe that the military should do anything. And I thought Russia was being imperialist at the time. And I thought that they were being warmongering and usurping on Ukrainian territory. Of course, this was on the heels of a U.S.-sponsored coup. Right. So the U.S. had just, you know, we saw Victoria Nuland saying, fuck the EU on that phone call. Who are we going to put in the cabinet? All of these things were happening in the context. So every day I was speaking out against what the U.S.'s role was doing in Ukraine and what the U.S. was doing around the world. But the second that Russia started doing something that I felt strongly about, and I, as an anti-imperialist, as an anti-militarist, I was concerned about what I was seeing on television and in the news. And here's the thing that really cemented it for me. It wasn't just the fact that Russia was incurring in Crimean space, which I know now they voted in a referendum and felt like they should be sovereign and under Russian control, whatever. At the time, what I felt most uncomfortable with was that it was deja vu and a throwback to the Bush administration propaganda about Iraq, where RT itself was absolutely just 100% became a state arm of Russia at that point. They mm-hmm. all were repeating all of the things coming out of the government about the Ukrainian incursion. Everyone started reporting, all of the anchors that were set up around the world were just reporting what felt like very overt propaganda to me, that you know, Russian soldiers were being meted with candy and flowers mm-hmm. in Crimea. And so I just felt very uncomfortable because I felt for the first time that I was working at just a propaganda agency.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be a part of that. And so I told my boss that morning, and I remember talking to Robbie about this, and I was saying, what should I do? I don't feel comfortable doing this. And he said, just tell Mikhail, who was my boss, he said, just tell him that you want to speak out on air. And I told him, I said, Misha, I want to say this statement, and if you don't let me say it, I'm going to quit. And so I gave him the option. A lot of people have depicted this as me taking over the airwaves and, you know, kind of going renegade. But really, I went to him and consulted in a professional manner. I said, can I say this? And he said, yeah, go ahead and say it. And so I read this statement as I began the show about how I completely disagreed with RT and I disagreed with what Russia was doing. And he tried to remove it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Didn't know that part.
YouTube. Okay. Someone else had uploaded it. Of course, it's going out to millions of households around the world. I don't know how stupid he thought that he could actually just remove it. Like,
media.
Let me say it, but take it off YouTube and then it would not become a thing.
Right.
So it became a viral thing. I was a hot news story for about 2 days mm-hmm. before they really realized who I was, right? Mm-hmm. So I was touted as this anti-Russian hero who took over the airspace on RT to denounce RT and denounce the propaganda. Then it came out that I had a pretty controversial past.
Discrepancies in your ideology.
That I thought the U.S. was a criminal state. And
and other lukewarm statements.
And that I was very anti-Israel and, right. you know, that I had questioned 9/11. And so all of these things really, once reporters started picking up on this, then it just became a complete smear job, hatchet job. It was a reversal of the past 48 hours to say, actually, she's not who you think she is. But at that moment, this was 2 days after the statement on RT, a colleague of mine, Liz Wall, this is a really interesting facet of the story.
Yeah.
A colleague of mine who was my good friend up until that point, I thought she was very apolitical up until that point. For a couple months, I knew that she was very disgruntled about not getting paid enough, not getting enough help with the network. And also she was friends with this guy, Jamie Kirchick, who's a henchman for Bill Kristol. He was working
speaking
kind of an underling.
Speaking of identity politics used in the service of empire.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah, this is the guy, for people who don't know, he went on RT with rainbow suspenders during the Sochi Olympics and said, I protest RT's gay laws, and then made up the story about how RT kicked him off air and left him out on the street. That wasn't even true.
He was the one who informed all of us about how evil Putin was. He was the first person to sort of popularize this idea.
Yes.
Using the gay, the homophobia angle,
yes,
right, to get people,
totally.
To get the good liberals of LA and New York to hate Putin.
Exactly, exactly. So Liz Wall, 2 days after I said what I did, she quits live on air during her news broadcast. She didn't have a political show. She just was a kind of a generic anchor with no real political opinion. She quits live on air, says, I refuse to work for this propaganda. So basically one-ups me, right? And actually says, I can't work for this network. She's obviously reading a script while she's saying it. Mm-hmm. Then she has this media tour lined up for her. And while she's on the media tour, she kind of revealed that Jamie Kirchick was palling around with her, taking her around to these different news stations. She goes on, I think it was Lawrence O'Donnell that night, and says, Abby's crazy. Mm-hmm. Abby's a conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. And it started to become kind of not only talking about how she couldn't work for RT because it's a propaganda network, but I was the one who was kind of the plant being used to legitimize RT to a certain extent, because I proved that I had editorial freedom on a network that was completely dictated by the Putin government.
Yeah, doesn't quite work logically, but okay.
And Jamie Kirchick, of course, was preempting her and bolstering her up and going on these networks as well, saying I was a lunatic, a conspiracy theorist, and that Liz Wall was the real dissident here. So it was really sinister what was going on. And then it came out that the think tank that Jamie Kirchick worked for, which was not the Project for New American Century, the offshoot, which was the FPI, the Foreign Policy Initiative, which is actually defunct now. but he was working for a think tank run by Bill Kristol at the time. And before Liz Wahl did her on-air resignation, he was tweeting an hour before saying something big about is about to happen at RT through the FBI account. So it became very, very obvious that she was being puppeteered, essentially, from this neoconservative think tank, that they came to her. And especially when I did my on-air statement to it, which really did legitimize RT, because I said, look, I didn't lose my show. I still was on air for 6 months after this until I chose to leave on my own terms. And the fact that my boss let me do it. And so it was a big threat to them. And it came out that Jamie Kirchick was trying to get Liz Wahl to throw RT under the bus, do a giant tell-all months before that happened. And when I did what I did, he said, we need to pull the trigger now. And went to her and said, here's the script, do it. And then lined up this media tour with her. And it's just so obvious that she has no convictions and no even understanding of why she did what she did, because she can't actually point to anything that she was told from the network to parrot Russian propaganda. And it was just really strange. I think her best example in interviews she gave was that she was like questioning Ron Paul, and her boss said, no, don't ask this question, ask this question. It's like, that's what you're going to get at any news network.
Yeah. I watched most of this and most of the videos, and I followed most of it. And my take is essentially your take. I mean, I think she was basically being used by the neocons to do what you were saying. I want to pause though.
Yeah,
I want to
sure.
say something about you though. You were on state run media.
Yeah, right.
Russian media controlled by Putin, essentially, right? And you got up on their cameras and you said, you called them imperialists, and you denounced their major foreign policy initiative as an act of imperialism and aggression against a sovereign nation. You did that. People can look it up. It's easy to find. That's, even though we have disagreements, one of the coolest, most badass things I've ever seen done in the media by anyone in my lifetime.
Well, thank you.
Abby Martin. Yeah. You're just wrong about a few things, but that's okay. No, but that was really, I mean, that really showed that you're an independent thinker, you know, and you really, really care about imperialism, and you're really opposed to it, even if it's another country doing it, right? I mean, that's rare. That's really rare. I don't see that very often on the left, the right, anywhere. Super cool.
Thanks. And, I mean, I felt like I wanted to prove my integrity and independence, and I was willing to risk my job to do it, which I think is a lot more than a lot of people working in the media can say.
Now, here's the funny thing.
Sure.
Okay, so Russia, you know, I am totally convinced, spent some money trying to affect the U.S. elections in 2016. What did they spend? About 50 grand or something, and they put up like a half a dozen Facebook ads that no one could even make sense of. Utterly ridiculous. Then you get up there and denounce the whole damn regime for this thing, and you don't even get fired. And you kept it, as you said, you kept your job for another 6 months or so, right? Which leads me to believe that these people are not to be feared. If anything, they're somewhat incompetent.
Absolutely.
As like, if they really were as totalitarian and as effective at subverting democracy and taking over the world, you'd have been long gone. Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the utter incompetence of how RT was really managed is laughable.
I mean,
I wish people could really just put a camera in that network and just see how terrible it really is. And you know, you can really get away with a lot, which was why it was so comical to have this depiction that, you know, we sat at this round table where Putin comes in every morning. He's like, here's your talking points and it was just a joke. I mean, you look at that. I had Joe Rogan talking about DMT, Amber Lyon coming in talking about her ayahuasca trip.
Well, that's right.
So it was just like getting away with so much that Misha my boss never even watched the program at all. It was only when there was some sort of controversy that was picked up did he kind of pay attention.
The show that I was on was Crossfire. Was that the name of it?
Yeah. That's a wild show.
That was a weird show. So first time I was on with Angela Keaton of antiwar.com, and we were just up there, you know, denouncing the empire. That was great. They loved me and they invited me back on, and that was about Rupert Murdoch and his, when he was tapping phones or whatever that was.
Yeah, right.
And I actually made a point on behalf of Rupert Murdoch. I said, he's the one who broke the media monopoly in this country. He made things like RT and Jon Stewart and The Daily Show all possible simply by challenging the rules, you know, which gave the ABC, NBC, and CBS a monopoly in the 80s. I didn't say anything good about his politics, just that by doing that, he did a good thing for all of us in media, which is true. And they just weren't happy with me. And clearly that was unacceptable. And I was never invited on again. So that's my history with RT. But all right. So, I mean, I do think that's a great moment in journalism history that I should be taught in journalism school, what you did. I really mean that. What have you been doing since then?
So since then, I left RT and joined Telesur, which is a conglomerate of Latin American countries, including Venezuela and Cuba and Ecuador, Argentina, Chile. And so for 2 years, I was selling a show that I'd created with my partner, Mike Preisner, called The Empire Files, which is looking at the issues of the world domestically and abroad through the lens of U.S. empire. So I think that truly, we cannot look at any issue without understanding that we are the greatest empire that's ever lived, that we're the most powerful entity.
Even domestic issues.
Absolutely.
Right?
Of course. That's what everything. I've been saying too. No, because it all funnels through the spending of the military.
Even the psychology of
Absolutely.
Americans, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. The militarization of society. And it's really, really shocking. But it's really the premise of everything is our military empire and this notion that we are better than everyone and that we have the preordained right to do whatever we want around the world.
Duty.
So anyway, that's the show that we created because I felt like it's really crucial and also completely omitted through a lot of context with alternative media even these days. No one really focuses first and foremost on the fact that we are a huge empire and it is destroying everything around the world. So we created this weekly show that was a 30-minute show and we sold it to Telesur. Telesur had no editorial control over our content whatsoever. I could have uploaded a propaganda piece against Hugo Chavez undermining Cuba directly on their YouTube channel and no one would have told me no because I had direct access to upload my content. We just happened to fall in line with the political ideology of what Telesur represented. And Telesur was created as a joint project between Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro to counter corporate media hegemony and corporate media propaganda that was being used to undermine and overthrow their countries.
This is the thing. People don't understand. Communists are just totally undisciplined and disorganized. My father told me that the reason he left the movement, the Trotskyist socialist movement in Berkeley back in the 70s, he said, socialists, they can't even run a drugstore, much less a country. And I think that's true. So, I mean, it's kind of what you're speaking to here. I mean, that doesn't mean necessarily anything about their politics or their ideas, but
Cuba's doing pretty well.
Do you think so?
Absolutely. They have the first...
Oh, God. Here we go.
No, I mean, they have a lot of...
How are they doing
a lot
well?
Of amazing things.
They're falling
I mean, the
apart.
Fact that... Well, of course. Why are they falling apart? Because the
embargo.
U.S. is waging a genocidal embargo on them for decades.
100% agree on the embargo. It's an act of war that should have never happened. And is actually, I agree with you here, in many ways, it has forced the regime to be more authoritarian at times.
Sure.
It's trapped people inside the country.
And it's
kept things from coming into the country that could liberate them, like media. Right.
That's the thing is if the U.S. was out of the equation and if these entities were not constantly trying to subvert any sort of progressive or socialist revolution around the world, I don't think that there would be this reaction to suppress alternative speech. And it's really hard to argue for that case. But I think that without the U.S. taking its tentacles out of everything, I don't think that we could really see honestly or have an honest analysis about where these countries would be and what they would be doing.
That's a fair point. That's a very fair point.
That's what I was trying to say earlier when I got mired down. But I think that Cuba... No, it's fine. I think that Cuba has shown great potential. I mean, the fact that they export doctors around the world. Doctors are on the front lines of every natural disaster, every humanitarian disaster, all doctors from Cuba, right? And that's amazing to me that we are exporting weapons and Cuba's exporting doctors. The fact that they can train doctors for free anywhere around the world. You can go to Cuba if you live anywhere and you could just become a doctor. You train in how to be one. That's an incredible feat. The fact that they've created the first elimination of HIV transmission to a child. That's a vaccination that they've created, the first lung cancer vaccination. Things like that, that are really big medical breakthroughs for a small, tiny island nation that is under a genocidal embargo. The fact that they've advanced these technologies is astounding to me.
They've also exported some of the very best baseball players, boxers, and wrestlers because they chose to invest heavily through a command and control economy into those industries, right? So, I mean, the regime or the government of Cuba chose medicine for various reasons, I'm sure, just to shore up popular support, but also to show to the world that we're good in this way. I mean, I'm a little cynical, right, about this. Is that fair? I mean, that it was not just humanitarian goodwill that drove those policies of investing heavily in medicine in Cuba, do you think?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that when we're looking at a socialist economy versus a capitalist one, capitalism's based on profit making, and you can interpret a socialist economy based on human needs.
Okay. All right, let's do the capitalism thing real fast. All right. So, there's nothing in my view that is more threatening to those regimes than people underneath those governments watching television, listening to radio, listening to music. You know, in Cuba, because everything was banned, people would hang wire hangers out their windows to pick up the radio stations from Miami. And that was the only way they could get that information. Capitalism, the products of capitalism, in particular pop culture, I have found, mm-hmm. right? And for particular sort of lowbrow, so-called lowbrow pop culture, that's what people in those countries are much more interested in. This goes for Muslim countries too. You find that they're way more interested in Beyonce than they are in reading Das Kapital or in listening to Fidel's speeches. You know, they're very interested in music videos and blue jeans and tattoos and heavy metal and hip hop and all the rest of it. This is very true, I think, across the Middle East and in Cuba and in North Korea and in Venezuela. And they're moving, especially young people, moving toward that, toward the sort of what I call the politics of pleasure, you know, in some ways, and away from the discipline, the rigor, the self-sacrifice that socialism and democracy even require. So to me, if it weren't for that, which is totally a product of capitalism in this country, those regimes would be much safer ground. And I think that that what we're giving to those people through especially media and pop culture is a form of liberation that they're voting with their feet by simply consuming it against all odds, like hanging, you know, wire hangers out their windows, are showing that's what they're into, that's what they really want. I think more than a collective economy in which everybody goes to meetings and determines how we run the neighborhood. That was a big, massive anti-socialist critique I just gave you there. I know. I'll give you a second.
Keep going.
No, I'm done. Does that make sense at all in any way?
Yeah, I don't think it's either or.
Okay.
I don't think that you have to block out entertainment and pop culture and Americana in terms of that way. And I don't think it's as you depict either, where people are rigidly, you know, standing in line and everyone's wearing the same outfits and we all go to meetings and we're all just deciding collectively how to run the economy. I think that it's really, again, these are countries that are under an economic war and their lives are literally at stake. I mean, Venezuela, from the last 2 years, 40,000 people died from sanctions. So this is a life or death issue. In Iran, I think a lot of people are very well versed in American culture.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's why I think that regime's days are numbered.
And
not because of the U.S. military, mm-hmm. because people have satellite dishes on tops of their houses. Everybody watches TV through satellite dishes, foreign television.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the greatest threat.
I think that you can have a mix of pleasure and entertainment, and you can also have a economy that works for the needs of the people, and that you can collectivize working class people to be a part of that instead of just a tiny number of elites that shrinks every single year.
You do know about Che's position on rock and roll, don't you?
Enlighten me.
He was against it and
well,
banned
I mean,
it.
I don't, that,
and
that's
banned
the thing.
It.
I think we're speaking in such binary terms. It's like, I don't agree. Like, I'm not like a staunch, like I believe in everything that these people believed in,
sure.
And I can argue to the death for them. I think that that's kind of a restrictive.
That's why we're talking. I wouldn't talk to you if you were one of those people. No, I just wanted to throw that out there for maybe you to chew on. I mean, I think there's a reason that Fidel and Che were opposed to rock and roll and all forms of they banned American pop culture. The Soviet regime did too. North Korea, of course, does as well. I think, well, they did see it as a threat because they see there's a particular kind of personal, individualistic, primal freedom in that kind of pop culture that is counter to any kind of discipline, whether it's capitalist industrial discipline, mm-hmm. right? Capitalists don't want their workers in their cubicles watching YouTube videos, right? They don't want the workers in their cubicles thinking about what's on TV. It's the same here, mm-hmm. right? Even under capitalism, I agree with you there. Any regime that wants order, efficiency, control to some extent of the populace is going to be hostile to that kind of popular culture, right? Where it's just anarchic dancing, fucking, drinking, playing, partying, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. right? And so that's what I promote, actually, is sort of the lowbrow culture just being disseminated. We don't have to do anything about it. Just let it go. People love it, and they're consuming it all across the world against all odds. Like in North Korea, you know, they're bringing in like sacks full of USB or flash drives that are full of basically the internet and television shows and music mm-hmm. videos, and they're distributing it in North Korea. You know, I mean, even there, and that's what's much more popular than the Kim regime or communism.
Yeah, no, I just think that I think it's completely separate. I think like to say that we either need one or the other, I think is a wrong approach. I mean, why can't we have both?
We could have socialism and pop culture and twerking. I don't know. Abby, I think socialism and twerking don't go together. I think there's an inherent hostility between the two, antagonism between the two. I really do.
Why can't we have an economy that works for everyone, be a part of that economy without having this kind of restriction?
Because socialism requires
fundamentalism,
discipline and work, right? To make it work. Everybody's got to participate.
So does capitalism. Oh, I mean, what do you
definitely
mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, but it's different. Socialism requires that all of us have that consciousness, that we all subsume some part of our individual identity to the collective, right? We have to put away our individual needs and desires to work for the collective. And the collective, the obligations are bigger under socialism, aren't they, than under capitalism? Because we are responsible for the whole society, aren't we, as the ruling class,
I mean,
the working class?
Participation, absolutely. Where under capitalism, people just slave away their whole lives and feel like they're separate from what they create.
Right, but capitalists don't need us to care about the rest of society. They just need us to work for them.
And care only about ourselves?
Maybe. Yeah, but there's no obligation under capitalism itself, to have that sort of global social consciousness and responsibility.
What I do know is that I think that capitalism is not working for the world,
okay,
especially not for America. I think that pop culture and entertainment is a good effect of whatever the fuck the system has created here. Yeah. That's like the one benefit, you know, that we have. We have some pretty cool music and art coming out of this.
Not the only benefit. The bridges are pretty good, you know.
The bridges are pretty good. Oh my God, are you kidding me? Everything's falling apart. The infrastructure is
terrible. The ones that are built by the government, yeah.
Oh, come on. I mean, the whole argument of we should give the government less power and give corporations more, I think is absurd.
Oh, I'm not making that argument. All right, let's, because I think we're nearing maybe the end here. I want to talk about culture, a different kind of culture. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know. But this is something I bet you're rarely, if ever, asked. Although I warned you before I sent an email about this. I didn't know this until I started doing a little more research on you before this interview. You're an artist.
Yeah.
You're a painter, primarily. Is that right?
Yeah.
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 And you have a whole website that's full of paintings. You've been a very busy artist and painter. You've produced quite a bit. You're prolific. Some of it is explicitly political, some mm-hmm. of the art. Some of it is not. Am I right?
Yes.
Some of it, I don't see any explicit political statements in, right? Okay. I'm gonna give a shot at describing it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
dense.
Yeah.
Meaning that there's just a lot going on, mm-hmm. right? Per square inch. There's just all sorts of activity and personas and characters and shapes and figures in it. Highly colorful.
Yes.
Right? Lots and lots of color. It reminds me a bit, not entirely, but a bit of, or it's, I'd say it's reminiscent of sort of 60s psychedelic art.
Yeah.
Yes, did I get it?
Yes.
Cool. Okay. And tell people the name of the site so they can...
abbymartin.org, you can check out.
Confirm my analysis, my little amateur art critique there. So that's unusual for a full-time professional political activist of any persuasion, right? Because most of us are just political geeks with not much of a life outside of politics. Right. So you've clearly spent a big chunk of your life doing something that's not serving the cause. It's not necessarily political. And you spend so much time on it. Clearly, I mean, these are very intricate, is another word I would use. Intricate works of art. My God, how do you have the time? Why do you do it? What's that all about? And why don't you just do that?
And how do I do both when I'm a socialist and I still express myself individually?
Here's
right?
what I want to know.
Through art.
That's right. Individualism, Abby, is very bad for you as a socialist.
It's all for the cause. Everything is
Here's
for
what
the
I
cause.
Really want to know. Here's what I really want to know. Wouldn't you rather be doing just art?
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't I rather things not be so fucked up where I feel like I need to fill some sort of void and vacuum that is not being interpreted properly? Yeah, of course. I wish that people were not living in dire poverty. I wish that three homeless people weren't dying every day in the streets of LA, right down the street. Mm. I wish a lot of things. I wish our government wasn't killing tons of poor people around the world mm-hmm. with bombs that I'm sponsoring. I wish that Palestine wasn't under occupation. All of these things that stem from the actions of my criminal government that I am directly participant in, mm-hmm. just by being an American citizen. Yeah, of course. I wish in a perfect world, I could just focus on something that really makes me happy, that I'm not looking at horrible, miserable things that make me very sad 24/7. And also just being kind of putting myself out there for just being abused and criticized constantly every day.
I wouldn't call your art happy. It's intense. That's another word I would use. Right. It's very intense.
But it makes me happy doing it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, sure. It makes me happy doing it.
How long have you done it?
I've done it since I was 19 is when I really started to paint, but I grew up in a ceramic shop. My grandma had a ceramic shop in a kiln, and we would paint all these little figures. My brother's also an amazing artist. He draws really well. Huh. So I just started doing like abstract painting and just seeing where it took me. And over the years, it's kind of turned into really intricate collage work where I will take collage and use paint pens and just do hundreds and hundreds of layers on top of images until it just becomes totally indistinguishable from what I started. And it's a series of dots and swirls upon many, many, hundreds of layers of paint.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
And it's clearly the work of someone who knows what she's doing.
Thank you.
You don't have kids, right?
No.
Are you planning on having kids?
Yes.
That's where the art goes away. So, Abby,
I feel like a lot will go
don't
away.
Don't have kids. You won't be Abby
a
Martin
lot
anymore.
Will go away.
I think
you have, how many kids?
I have only one, but that's enough. I couldn't be an artist. Once he was born, I gave up like all my social life, all the fun stuff. I was just work.
Still doing what you're doing.
I just do work and politics, though. Yeah. You know, but oh, you want to have kids, huh? Well, all right. We'll see. I hope you can continue to do all these things. And you'd still do it. Like,
yes.
It must be like daily or weekly, right?
Yeah. So it's part of my therapy. I think that everyone can do it. You know, everyone has that in them. I think that we're beaten into our subconscious that we aren't artists, that, you know, art and music are first things cut from education. And I think that that's a really big detriment to society. I think that everyone has creative expression inside them. Going back to the whole antithesis of what you're saying about like, if you're a socialist, you can't be this.
You can't be fun.
I think that everyone has this inside of them. And it's all up to you to find how you can express yourself in a way, whether musically or whatever medium that you choose. But I think it's a beautiful thing. It is.
Okay, now after the revolution, right? We're going to have to, hang on now. We're going to have to make collective decisions, right? About the economy, aren't we? Okay. Now, how are you so confident that the people are going to vote to allow you to continue wasting your time? Well, maybe they won't. To continue indulging your interest in art. How do you know that? How do you know the socialist collective, the demos, the people, when they take over and they have control, and they decide what is produced. That's right, isn't it? Socialism is the people deciding what is produced and what is consumed, or certainly what is produced. How do you know they're going to let you do that?
Look, all I know right now is that our economy is producing.
You are dodging the question.
You're approaching the question wrong by kind of fear-mongering about what socialism is in the theoretically based on hardcore authoritarian structures that call themselves socialist and communist in the past, where to me, I'm looking at the abject failure of capitalism right now, which we haven't actually argued about, just in terms of how successful capitalism is, right?
Oh, okay.
How successful is the system that we're living under? You think it's a success?
Oh.
The climate is teetering on the edge of collapse. We're on the precipice of like cataclysmic environmental degradation.
I thought you had to go. Don't you have to go right now? Don't you have an appointment somewhere?
You know. Inequality just continues to sharpen every single year.
No, no, and no is the answer to all those things.
So how can capitalism be reformed?
So the capitalism we have in this country is not exactly pure free market capitalism. In fact, it's very, very far from how capitalism works.
I mean, monopolies take over and...
Oh, God. You're going to have to come back on. We'll go through this again. So, no. Read Gabriel Kolko. Do you know about this guy?
No.
He's a Marxist historian and economist who wrote that monopolies emerged in this country and elsewhere through state intervention, actually. That the intervention of the state, regulation... gave advantages to certain corporations who then developed monopolies out of that.
But you're acting like there's no market influence on those state decisions.
Why? No. I mean, the state has the monopoly on violence. It can do whatever it wants. So it can play favorites. It can pick certain industries over others, certain businesses over others, certain artists over others, which it does all the time, right? Why? Yeah.
It's fascinating to, yeah. I mean, to me, I look at the libertarian ideology and I'm like, so you want to
call me
more...
a libertarian. I'm not
a
libertarian.
No. Even just the capitalist ideology where people who are tend to think that small government is the best solution. To me, looking at the problems of the world, it seems like corporations have pretty much destroyed everything. They control our entire government, and to take away any semblance of democracy or influence from people into that system seems wrong and counterintuitive. But
okay. This will be Martin Russell 2 for that. I just want to, I'll leave you with one thing. Okay. The great historian, Marxist, socialist historian for sure, Howard Zinn.
Yes.
He said that government is the greatest killer of all. Government has murdered more people than any other entity. Government. Just saying. I thought he had a point. Not capitalists, not corporations. Government. That seems indisputable.
On behalf of who? Who are you killing for? You're killing and expanding empire to protect and expand capital. That's actually the highest stage of what Marx talked about, is imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism.
Lenin did.
Okay,
Lenin. That was Lenin, but that's okay. Same thing. No, I actually think these imperialists in the government believe that the United States has a God-given duty, as we said.
So you think it's philosophical instead of actually trying to expand?
I think it's philosophical and psychological.
What?
Yeah, I think
you
these
don't
guys
think it has
are crazy.
Anything to do with economics?
No.
What?
Well, except that economics is a vehicle to expand the American empire. You have to control oil to have an American empire, so that's why they seize the oil, etc. Sure. No, these guys are true believers. You don't think? I had this argument with your brother. Didn't you talk to him? Crystal. Podhoretz, the neocons, all the imperialists, Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, you name it. They really believe this shit about America. You've said this yourself, that America is exceptional. We're the best country on earth, and we are obligated to raise up the world's people so that they can live like us. They really believe that.
But part of that indoctrination process is believing that capitalism is the supreme ideology, and that we almost buy into this notion that we must be a capitalist society. I mean, I think that it's
yes.
it's not
yes.
fair to not take in the factor that gaining resources and acquiring these things is pushed by market forces. And to compete, you could argue that since World War I, capitalist entities, you know, fighting amongst each other led to the US being supreme, reasserting itself as the dominant empire. And since then, it's been expanding into markets because that's the nature of what the system does.
Yeah, they've overwhelmingly believed in state-managed markets being best, as well as our version of liberal democracy being best. And that's what they have exported as hard and as fast as they could for now 200 years, really, because it goes all the way back to the founding fathers. I think these people are psychos. I think they really are megalomaniac psychos.
So you think it's about putting the right kind of people in power?
No, it's them. They believe that they are the true rulers of the earth and should be rulers of the earth.
So you think
I'm talking about the people in government.
Right, but I'm saying
the people at Google.
If we replaced people in government with people who just want to do the right thing, then therefore things would go well.
No, not necessarily, because I don't believe the state, the government, the state itself has its own interest, which is not
what
our
about
interest.
Google?
Google is outside the state. Google can't arrest
Google,
you, can't
you
put
Google
you in prison.
Google has good interests at play, like they
not always. Sometimes when they work with the government, I'm not a fan of theirs. Yeah, but you know, but they started out just by wanting to have a search engine, you know, which they thought would be good for us, which they were right. It's the greatest invention of all time, like the greatest invention of all time, isn't it? Google.
I don't know if Google's the greatest invention of all.
Of course
time.
It is. Get out of here. You have an appointment somewhere. We are done for now, but we'll be back. I think you're awesome, even though we have major disagreements. I do, and I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing with the Empire Files. Glad you've been doing what you did for years, and I do think your statement on RT on that day was one of the great heroic moments in the history of American journalism.
Wow, that's amazing.
Straight
Thank
up.
You so much, Thad. I appreciate you.
Thank you for coming, and
Thank
I hope
you.
To do this again.
Yes, me too. Next
cool.
time you're in LA.
All right. Awesome.
Okay.
Thanks. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To become a member of the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com.
and thanks for listening.